All right, ladies, buckle up.
It's showtime. It's showtime.
It's showtime.
It's showtime.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Matinee Talk, episode 34, another special episode where Julian and I will be reviewing Joker. How are you doing this morning, Julian?
I'm actually doing really well this morning. How are you?
Doing great. Loving the weather that blew in yesterday. So here in Austin, Texas, we are no longer sweltering.
It feels so good, and I really am enjoying it. But, I mean, let's get started with the numbers for the weekend. Let's get into some Joker news. So, for number one, with breaking October domestic box office of all time, Joker coming in with $96 million. Again, breaking it. And it's the fourth largest rated R domestic opening for any film.
I thought it was fourth. Second.
So I found out they said fourth.
Yeah, I think behind the first. I'm going to check them.
Yeah, it said the fourth largest for rated R feature. I don't know who the other three are, but yeah, it said fourth. Double check me on that. Number two is Abominable.
Yep, it is the fourth.
Number two is Abominable with $11.9 million, bringing its domestic total up to $37. Downton Abbey getting another $7.9 million, with it bringing its domestic total up to $73 million. Wow, Downton Abbey is making a lot of money. Hustlers bringing in $6.3 million, bringing its domestic total up to $91.4 million. And rounding out with number five is It Chapter 2, bringing up $5.3 million, bringing its domestic total up to $202.1 million.
Yeah, I mean, the standout definitely is Joker, even with all of the theater scares and the threats and whatnot, and the bad press talking about how a film like this was going to incite violence, which we'll get into in the review, still broke the all-time October weekend record.
I'm not surprised, but that's very intriguing that after everything that has happened this weekend, or everything that was supposed to happen this weekend, it still broke records. And I mean, I guess that says a lot. Which we're going to talk about in the review. I'm kind of surprised that it's not being talked about as much, but like I said, we'll get into that in the review. From my aspect, I'll explain why that's all there. But before we get there, we have, I guess, one more thing we want to discuss real quick.
Yeah, it's not set in stone, but more than likely next Monday, October 14th, will be when the third Episode 9 Rise of Skywalker trailer will drop, along with ticket sales. Traditionally, it happens in October during a Monday Night Football.
Yep.
Typically, it happens after a few weeks after Force Friday. Force Friday was last Friday. For all the people running around trying to get your Star Wars merch, good luck.
I was just going to ask you, have you seen any toys that like caught your eye?
Oh, press? Yeah, I already got everything.
Oh, you already got everything you need?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Amazon Treasure Truck. I got first editions of the whole thing. Yep.
Wow. All right. I must see photos and everything later after the podcast, because I was upset that we didn't, Best Buy is supposed to be getting more toys due to Toys R Us being closed, and I really was looking so far. Oh,
each store got, one figure.
Yes, and I barely missed it. You know, and I'm so mad that we only got maybe one or two figures. So I'm mad that we didn't get anything. So definitely, I'm going to be trying to look, but I guess it's all too late because it's literally 4 days afterwards. So it is what it is. So I'm just going to live spiritually through you.
Yeah, what's crazy is I actually was being a nutball and got up early and went and stood out in line at the Target down there, because the Target down where near where we live in North Austin, they just got converted to where they added a Disney store inside the Target.
They did?
And they're one of only 25 in the whole country. So obviously there's a lot of people there. And it was people running around trying to get stuff. Got a few things. And then I went to GameStop because they did an exclusive thing for Jedi Fallen Order. So I went there to get that. And then right after that, I was like, man, this sucks. And then right then I got a text message that said, like, now in the Amazon treasure truck, full case, all 8 first editions in white box. And I was like, purchase all at retail, pick it up in 30 minutes. No more hunting.
Oh my God. And you have all of them right now, don't you?
Yep.
Oh God dang it. All right. You know what? All right, cool. I'm upset, but it's okay. It's okay. Like I said, I'm gonna live spiritually through Johnny. But yes, it's hopefully this is something that everybody will be waiting on. I hope that the pre-sales, like they've been doing for the last 2 films with The Force Awakens and Last Jedi, that they do it on this pre-game. I mean, they do it right after Star Wars Friday, and then you get the pre-sales. Yeah, it's just hopefully we get it. Like, hopefully we get this new trailer. Hopefully it doesn't show a lot again, like how J.J. Abrams has been doing it. But
well, that's another thing. Like, speaking of Force Friday, they only released like very few things.
Yes,
because apparently 70% of the Rise of Skywalker merchandise contains some form of spoiler, so they could barely release any of it.
I guess that's the crazy thing about all of this, is like, we're still like, at least with Star Wars this year, they try so much to not spoil anything with their toys, whereas with Endgame, whereas with Infinity War, like, they kind of just released toys and all of a sudden they had some kind of potential spoilers for the film. So I'm excited, but then still it's like, why are we not getting all of the toys out now?
Oh, it's the JJ mystery box.
I know, but it's, I guess because he's doing a big commercial franchise, I'm like, maybe we'll get a little bit more, but I mean, I guess.
No, it was, what's crazy is the same thing happened with Force Awakens. Like, they only did, like, a Rey. She didn't have a lightsaber. They did a Kylo Ren, a Stormtrooper, a Finn, and a Chewie. And, like, that was it. And it was like, dude, this is the first Star Wars movie in, you know, 10 years, and they did like 4 or 5 things, and then the rest of it came out around Christmas time because of spoilers.
So then let me ask this, out of the additions that you have, what are the additions?
Well, see, the thing is, they're lucky that they have Jedi Fallen Order and The Mandalorian coming out at the same time, because they did the Triple Force Friday. Right. So really, like, out of the stuff I got, there's only like half of it is even Rise of Skywalker. The other stuff is Mandalorian and Jedi Fallen Order.
Okay.
Because they were smart like that. They were like, okay, well, we can only release like 4 figures from Rise of Skywalker, so we'll just also release Mandalorian and a Jedi Fallen Order guy and a second sister from the video game. Which, okay, I'm cool with because they look cool, but
you still, I mean, for me, it would be like, I wish we can get just a little bit more of Rise of Skywalker stuff. But say all that to say, I'm kind of excited for the next 2 months for Star Wars. I'm kind of excited for actually the next round of films that we could be getting for the next 2 months. And I guess for me, which started that off was this film, The Joker. I watched it twice this weekend, just to give full transparency. I watched it twice because the first time, I was like, okay, maybe I'm just too hyped about it. Let me go rewatch it again. So I watched it with one of my friends, and wow. Absolutely wow. Before I get into it, basically, what did you think of it, Johnny? What did you think of Joker this year? I know we're going to have talk about it more in depth in review about how it ties with Batman, but, like, yeah, as a film, how did you feel about Todd Phillips' Joker?
I really enjoyed it. I felt like it hit the right beats. The story itself, it is a very dreary story, but I mean, we've seen these kind of stories before in, you know, King of Comedy and Taxi Driver, things of that nature. And so this is like, that's one of the thing with all the publicity and whatnot, is these types of films have come out before. The difference is they didn't have the name Joker, or they weren't tied to a larger franchise. It was, so that's, to me, that's really the only difference. and everything else is kind of being blown out of proportion because there have been films like this before.
And that's where, I guess, for me, which we will get more, I guess, do you want to wait until they have this conversation, the spoiler-free review, or do you want to have this conversation now about, like, the controversy, reason why it's at, the score it is on Rotten Tomatoes at this point?
I mean, we can get into that in spoilers. Okay. It is interesting to me that when, quote-unquote, just the real critics were getting to see it and review it, it was sitting at or around 100%. And then once all of the fanboys who happened to get Rotten Tomatoes credentials because they write reviews on their homemade websites and they write a ton of them. So that's, to be quite frank, that's really all you have to do to get Rotten Tomatoes credentials is you have to put out enough written reviews, or I believe you can also do video reviews.
Yes,
you can. With enough frequency for X amount of time, and then you can submit yourself to get credentials to. It's basically if this isn't your full time job and it's something you just do on the side, like on the websites and things like that, you're spending a lot of time doing this stuff just to get that tomato. And I don't get it. I think Rotten Tomatoes, I think you should have to be a reviewer for an accredited, like, newspaper or website. You can't be Joe Blow at the movies. You can still do your reviews. Please do your reviews, promote your site, go on Twitter, write your reviews, but I don't think it should garner a place on the tomato meter, which for a lot of people who only see a few movies a year, their entire basis for going to the movies is based on that tomato score. And most of them do not go and actually read the reviews that are in the tomato score, because that's one of my favorite things is once I got done with it, I came home and I was combing through the, I was like, wow, it went down to a 69. I was like, I really want to know who thought this was a bad movie and why. So I just started scrolling through some of those reviews, and I was like, who the hell are you? Who the hell are you? And then I would go to their website, and I was like, huh, your website looks like something I did in, like, a web development class in high school.
And
obviously, you're legit.
And see, for me, I was going to say, onto that notion, I will put it this way, and I guess this is why me and some of my friends who consider themselves cinephiles, we have a big fight about this. I've stopped giving a shit about Rotten Tomato scores a very long time ago.
For me, I have a handful of I don't go by the Rotten Tomato score. There's a handful of reviewers, yes, that I trust, whether it be if they see something and they talk about it on Twitter, like, I trust those people. That I know I have taste in line with them.
Right.
So those are the people I follow. So I would recommend to anybody, stop looking at the tomato meter and find a few reviewers where you can see consistently that they've liked the majority of movies that you've really liked. Those reviewers have done reviews that are positive and have said the same things in their reviews that you find that you enjoyed about the movie, because then you're like, okay, obviously this critic, or if it's a home critic, fine, obviously has the same tastes as me.
Right.
Because especially in today's world, there's so many of those people who have an agenda, and it's just stupid. And it's
so annoying. Like, literally, like Johnny said, I was looking, and I say, okay, it's crazy for me how this movie went from 100% to 69%. You know, I get entertained by it. I want to know why people don't like it. Like, for instance, one of my other films, I mean, I guess it's a film, we'll call it a stand-up. One of the stand-ups this year, Netflix, is Dave Chappelle's Sticks and Stones, right? And that went from almost 90% to whatever it is. It's like almost 50% right now, 50 or something like that, due to the controversy and stuff like that, which we won't get into here for the politics and stuff like that. And that, and then a couple of other films this year where you're sitting there wondering, how did you get to where you go? Like, how did you get to this review and say exactly what you said for it to look like that, right? And, I mean, like you said, I guess for me, everybody is a little pissed or a little antsy that this is from a big IP. It's controversial in a sense because it's basically taking like Taxi Driver and just putting it in a comic book world and turning it on its belly, and people just have a problem with that. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand that, and I don't fathom that, and I don't get that. And so for me, that's why I stopped giving a crap about Rotten Tomatoes so long ago, because it's like it's a basis for people who just want to see it. But for me, like you said, I've been watching certain reviewers for the last 4 or 5 years where, hey, whatever they say, this is what I'm a, why, I mean, this is what I'm a, like, put my basis on. Or like I've been doing recently because of, you know, Matinee Talk, I really just cut all of that off, watch the film, go back and listen to the reviews, go back and listen to the conversations that has happened with the film to get to where I'm going, which is what I did with Joker. And I can honestly say I enjoyed that because it was crazy. Long story short, I think Johnny and I got out the film, out of the theater around the same time. Because as soon as, like, I tweeted my review, and I was like, let me see if Johnny texted and tweeted about his, and literally, you did yours, like, almost 5 or 7 minutes before mine. And I was like, okay, wow. All right, we both are on the same page, and we both watched it at the same time. And that's why I wanted to talk to you about this, because this movie has done some things that I don't think any comic book movie would have dared touch. And the way that Todd Phillips has placed himself into the comic book world, and how he did it was just, I guess for me, was phenomenal. Like, arguably, one of the best comic book films of this year. I would argue that.
Oh, I mean, for me, this is definitely the best comic book film this year. And I definitely put an exclamation point on film to Martin Scorsese's point that comic book movies are not films. And to his point, he should have said, in my opinion, or he should have said, not all comic book movies are films, because that statement I can agree with. There's plenty of comic book movies that are just commercials. and there's plenty of comic book movies that they're literally preying on people, and it's literally like it's a filler episode and one big storyline. It really is, like, could have been done without, but they're like, here's another couple $100 million movie. Million dollar movie, and we'll just bring it, getting those checks and everything. But I do think it was a really great feat that he was able to take this IP, take certain parts from the comic book or the movie characters, and then infuse it with something different, something, and I don't want to say, you know, but I mean, I have to say it's disturbing. It is somewhat controversial in the, not necessarily, because from what some people out there are saying, controversial based on what he does, I think it's controversial in what people are doing to him more so than what he's doing to people, because that's the disturbing part to me, is because there's plenty of movies out there that depict some sort of madman or crazy person doing atrocious things. We saw it in The Dark Knight. Freaking put a pencil through a guy's head. He burned a guy alive. He exploded Batman's quote-unquote girlfriend, Harvey Dent's girlfriend, blew him up. These aren't spoilers. It's a decade old, folks. That Joker killed a heck of a lot more people than this. Even Jack Nicholson's Joker killed a heck of a lot more people.
Even though his was a little bit more on the cartoonish side, just because
but of where it was. If you go by body count, though,
his body count was a lot. Yeah. He had a very huge body count compared to Joaquin's. But I guess for me, which made this one more unsettling than all of those, was the fact of not only, I guess for me, and this is something that I've been trying to wrap my head around, was, and that's why I guess I had to watch it for a second time, was you sit there and you're wondering, wow, like, Arthur had a very rough life, you know? And you sit there, and I guess for me, this is what the most unsettling part is about the movie, is it kind of sheds a light on how us as a society deals with people who have mental illnesses, right?
Exactly. That was what was most disturbing to me, is this is pretty accurate, but the thing that's not accurate is all of those people who are being failed by their families or society in general. Not all of those people go out and do what Arthur does.
Right. And that's why it's different in the sense of, like, all right, this guy just basically has enough of it. And because he has this, like, I guess in the word of the sense, like how I talk about Joker a lot, he has this part about him where he's like, you know what? For me to feel some kind of release, for me to feel some kind of, like, enjoyment in doing what I do, I gotta always do it to either A, make Batman feel like he has to fight me or has to psychologically find ways to uphold me without breaking his one rule, or how much can I bend Batman before he breaks that one rule, or how much fun do I get out of killing somebody, or how much power do I get from this movie, and I mean from doing this. And I feel like Joaquin's Joker does a really great job of showing you the transition, the compilation of everything to getting to that point. Like, the entire film, like, should we go into spoilers now, or should we?
Yeah, we can go into spoilers.
So, like, for instance, yeah, if you haven't seen Joker, I apologize. Like, you should pause this podcast right now, go watch the film, and come back, because I'm about to start spoiling a lot of shit, because, like, I really think this is more of a character study than anything, and we're about to dissect this film just a little bit. But you have been warned. When he goes into Subway with the three Gotham kids from the university who are supposed to be rich kids, and they're picking on him and shit like that, and he got that gun, he gets the gun and starts killing them, and after he kills all three of them, you start to see his body, I mean, his whole character takes that switch, right? And you see from that point that Joker, or Arthur Fleck, is becoming the impersonation, the character Joker, right? Mm-hmm. He's becoming more, he's getting happier. His power, the way he invests in himself and the way he's gaining power within himself starts growing more and more. And what I loved also is the fact that, like, he really didn't start dancing until after he started killing and killing and killing. And when he got to the point where he killed everybody that has gave him some kind of trauma or some kind of resistance, his dancing got so much more, not interpolated, but more fascinating, more, I guess, elegant, more like a theater piece, more of like, it's a, like he's doing an interpretive dance as he's going along, and it's becoming more and more expressional as he gets more and more power throughout the film. And I just, like, things like that just made me realize, like, this is a very peculiar film to talk about somebody who's literally just gone mad and just goes on a mad killing spree. And mm-hmm. I guess that's one of my greatest moments about this film, is just the progression for Arthur Fleck to get to the end game at the end of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting, like you said, character study where we get to see this guy, and then, you know, just hit, the world is crapping on him, right? And like I said, in my mind, this is a telltale sign of both the people close to you and society failing a human being by in the case of the family, abuse, and by the case of society, neglect.
Yep.
And, you know, the thing is, the signs were there, and he even, you know, is constantly reminding his psychiatrist about his medication. And then it's not until their final meeting that he even asks her, like, do you even listen to what I say? And he basically, you know, he's asking for help, He's not getting help because she probably sees 20 of him a day.
And I was just going to say that. And it was such an interesting moment to go to that point, because you're literally sitting, Arthur, when you see him for the first time talking to her, he's, you know, you could tell that he's not getting anything out of these therapy sessions. You see that he's, you know, it's just like a checkup. And the one moment after he kills those three kids and he feels that release, he's like, look, I'm letting you know now. I just have these negative thoughts that won't go away. And I need to find a way to wrangle that. I don't need to hear this typical bullshit that you're trying to feed me, because I need something more than that. And literally you can tell she cared but didn't care, because she says, you know, I'm sorry, Arthur. Funding stopped. This is going to be my last time seeing you. And I just want you to know, yeah, I'm sorry about life. But just so you know, people don't give a shit about people like us. And that's life. That's not how that should work, but okay. And I guess that's what really just kind of, like, again, that's one of those moments where Arthur was like, okay.
Well, and that's the thing, too, is that also gave him a disconnect as well, which ties back in the final scene later, where it's like, oh, these people who are, say, they're doctors who are trying to talk to me obviously don't care about me anyway. So, because that's the thing, too, in the film, there is a point where two characters go to Joker's apartment and he kills one of them. And he lets another one go and specifically says, you were the only one who was nice to me.
And I was going to say, what the craziest thing about that particular scene, I think his name was Randall. Randall is the one who got killed because he, I believe, which we will get into later in the film, I believe is the one who gave Arthur the gun that kind of, like, snowballed everything. So he kills him, and then there was this other friend that came in, and he's just scared. And for me, in both screenings of watching Joker, the audience is on the edge of their seats the entire time after he killed Randall, and he's telling the other one, hey, you know, I'm not gonna kill you, you can go. And we're all like, are you really about to let him go, or are you about to, like, kill him?
Well, what I liked was that scene, and Phillips does a great job taking that scene from, first of all, he looks really creepy when he just has the white face.
Yes.
With nothing else. Taking it from creepy, what is he going to do, to visceral and disturbing when he's just mangling this guy's face while he's killing him, while the small guy is just, like, watching in horror. And then he sits down. And then, yeah, you're in that suspense of, like, is he about to kill this guy? Like, what's going on? And then Phillips flips it to being comedic.
Very, and very well.
Yes. And it's such a Joker, like a Joker type of thing to do, where he'll put people in people be in these situations, and you're like, is he going to kill him, or is it like a joke that, oh, did he purposefully latch that because the guy is short? Because the guy is, like, freaking out because he can't reach the deadlock,
right? He can't reach the chain to get out of the door, and then Arthur has to go and get it for him. It was,
and then he gives him a kiss on the head.
Right, so he can leave. I'm just like, all right, this, a lot of things in this movie, you're sitting there and you're wondering, like, Arthur, it's a very interesting character, and you could tell that Todd has some kind of appreciation for Joker, because he does, as much as he deviates from the comic book origins of Joker, but at the same time, he does so many things to keep that really close.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, for instance, one of the best things for me was when, actually, the ending, right? The ending and learning about Zaza Beetz's character, right?
Because
you're sitting there, you're like, oh, so, you know, he has a roommate. I mean, not a roommate, but he has a neighbor that likes him, who's trying to invest time in him and things of that nature. And then all of a sudden, none of that shit was real.
That's the thing, too, is because you have him as essentially your protagonist, your narrator, it then makes you think about how much he's an unreliable narrator.
Yes.
Because you're like, okay, how much is in his head? And then you also wonder, how much was in his mom's head? How much was she telling the truth about? How much was she just crazy?
And to that point, I was going to ask, like, you know, I think, and one of my friends was trying to have this conversation, I told him, like, I don't think that that's what they were going with, but sure, I mean, I'll entertain it. Do you think Bruce and Arthur are related? No. After what the mom was trying to, like, write letters with Thomas and stuff like that?
I don't think so. My buddy Brett says yes, because of the photo.
I don't...
With the TW.
So my friend was trying to bring up that notion, too. It was the photo and then the handwriting on there. And we've been seeing her handwriting the entire time. So there's my friend was trying to say there's no way that that's, you know, her trying to mimic his handwriting or anything like that. And I was like, well, you got to think of it this way, too. And I guess this is just me looking on outside and hindsight and understanding Batman lore and me trying to put this together. They already said that she's narcissistic and that she has delusion, right? And so this is just me spitballing. If I am so invested in a certain dream or this certain idea that has happened in my life, I'm going to do whatever it takes to make sure that is as mm-hmm. authentic as possible. So I think personally, Arthur's mom forged that. So, you know, she lived in his house for so long. I mean, she lived and cooked and was cleaning around the Wayne's mansion. You could see so much in his handwriting. And I think what she probably did was...
See, like, I think that the handwriting was legit. But I think it's one of those things where if you are, she's this narcissistic, crazy person, that all it would literally take was somebody like Thomas Wayne being nice to her a few times, and then she starts getting these delusions that he's in love with her.
And then the kid that she adopted is actually his instead of being this kid that she adopted. Okay, that's fair. And then I guess for me, it's like, all right, one of the biggest things, I know probably everybody's going to be tired of hearing this, but I mean, it's the truth. You know, in The Killing Joke, Joker says, if I would have to have a backstory, I'd prefer it to be multiple choice. And I feel like Todd has done that with the ending really well. And I really want to know, I guess for me, it's like, for you specifically, what did you think of the ending? And what do you think what do you think it interprets? Or what about certain beats of the story does it interpret? Because for me, watching it for the second time, I had two different ways that it was going. For me, I thought, you know, Zaza Beats, I feel like that was made up. I feel like Randall giving him the gun was made up. Wasn't made up at first. I felt like him trying to go see Thomas Wayne was a thing, but I don't think he got to where he wanted. And then I felt like after he killed Murray, or Robert De Niro's character, everything after the car crash, all in his head. But then after watching the movie again, I feel like, I don't know if I'm accurate on this, but I think that majority of everything that has happened in the film was all in his head.
The only things I think were in his head were the relationship with Zazie Beetz. Like, that was obviously, he was imagining that and that's the thing I think he did really well early on. The first time he's sitting in the bed that he shares with his mom and they're watching the Maury show, and he has that dream about Maury on the stage. And I was like, oh, he looks up to this guy. He sees him kind of like a father figure. Same thing with Thomas Wayne, simply because of the things his mom's put in his head. So these are two father figures he thinks of. And then the whole, like I said, the thing with Zazie Beetz, obviously, that one I caught on to fairly quickly because I was like, why is this relationship so weird? Like, he killed those guys and then he walks in and she just like lets him come into her apartment where it's presumed they had sex. Right. And I was like, that's got to be a fantasy because that's one of those things. And I watch way too much like ID channel and stuff is like, like killers, like they get off when they kill. So it makes sense that the first time he kills people, he would be aroused and his first dream would be going to sleep with his neighbor. So that made sense. And then of course it made sense that his one thing that would encourage him when he's doing stand up would be, oh, she's there laughing at my jokes. Basically, she's always there when he needs something. He
like
needs,
comfort, yeah.
Like when his mom went to the hospital, she was there asking him if he needed coffee. She was giving him encouragement and everything. And so that was the only thing she was there for. And then once that kind of idea or the idea of her and a relationship was gone, I think that was just another snap for him.
And I was going to ask you, do you think that he killed her?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because that's the other thing too, is that they insinuate so many times that like fake shot to the head.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wish in the promotional material for this, they wouldn't have had that scene with him talking to Robert De Niro and asking him, hey, yes, can you call me Joker when you introduce me?
Or the like when she's playing like a fake gun, blowing herself in the head. Like those two big story moments, I don't think should have ever been in any promotional promotional stuff, because those are two very big pivotal moments in the film. And I guess you gotta find some way to appeal this film to somebody, to the audience. But at the same time, I'm not frustrated, but it's just, you know, you dropped really two big story points and just
that,
was like.
And then you also dropped a little bit of Murray making fun of his stand up in the promotional material, because up until that point in the film, you still got a sense that, like, up once they did that, I was like, oh, okay, so later on, he's going to introduce him as Joker, and then Joker's going to kill him. That was my thought process. And then leading up to it, because they were making so many gestures about suicide, I was like, oh, okay, he's going to go on the Murray Show and commit suicide. And up until that point, I do feel like that was his intention, was he intended to go out there, put on a little bit of a show for an entrance, and then shoot himself on TV. And because Murray picked and prodded at him, it made him snap.
He changed the course to the point where he was like, you know what? Nah, screw this whole idea. I'm going to just kill and then go on a rampage. And you can tell when he goes to On the Murray Show and talks to Murray, you can tell when the switch happens, he is tired. He's not tired. He's frustrated. And he's at the tipping point of, you know what? Fuck everything, you know? Because he got to the point where, you know, you got me on the show to make fun of me. You came on the show just so you can get some views and viewership off of me. And you are just like everybody else in society that just prey on people like us, who just makes us look stupid. You're like Thomas Wayne, who just prey on people, and then you expect us to just be okay with it, and now, no, we've had it. And I felt like that was such great commentary on where...
Well, and that's the thing, too, is even going into that, he said, oh, I don't care anything about those riots, and that, like, that doesn't concern me. Like, he doesn't care. And then when he, like, you could tell he was, like, looking forward to this. He was, like, practicing his entrance.
Right.
And then I was like, okay, are we going to get fully, like... Are we going to get fully formed Joker? Like, is he going to go out here and, like, outwit Murray to, like, put on a show or whatever? Because, okay, he just got through doing his dances coming down the stairs, and you know, he has eluded the two detectives who obviously know he's the killer now. And now he's getting ready to go on the show. He's all ready and he looks confident. And then he sits down and it's very uncomfortable, his conversation with Murray, because you're like, oh no, it was all a show. He is not confident. He's, you know, he is not okay. And he doesn't know how to react to what's being said to him and what's being done to him properly. Right. Because he does, like, his brain just doesn't function properly. Like, he doesn't know how to respond when somebody's bullying him.
And that's why I felt like this Joker was something I was hoping for, you know, and this is why I enjoyed it, because that entire Murray scene reminded me so much of the Dark Knight Rises, Dark Knight Returns sequence, when the Joker comes back after Batman comes back, and he basically kills everybody in the audience, including the late night talk show host. It reminded me of that, but it was more of like, instead of him being confident and knowing that he was going to exactly do, because he's been unreliable narrator this entire film, and the fact that he responds to violence in multiple different ways, you didn't know how this was going to go. Mm-hmm. And you didn't know if he was going to kill everybody or start just going on a rampage and shooting up people at a late night show host, or is he just going to kill Murray or anything like that. And so what I loved is they kept bringing up the tension building to the point where it's just like, explodes like it did. And the last final scene in that Murray sequence, when he's like, and don't forget always to smile, before they cut him off in like interruptingly and basically do the mass live news report of saying, you know, Arthur Fleck goes and kills, you know, late night show host Murray Franklin. And I just sat there and said, wow, this is what I feel like Joker would have been, unhinged, before he started polishing himself up, before mm-hmm. he becomes real Batman's arch nemesis. Like, this is what I wish, in a sense, we got a Heath Ledger Joker, like, beginning phase. Like, because I feel like this, and I don't know if you agree with me on this or not. I feel like Heath Ledger's Joker is basically the epitome of what the Batman the anime series Joker could have been if they let him off the hinges just a little bit more. And that's how I felt about that, because their dynamic in The Dark Knight was amazing, right? Like, I felt like that's literally how Batman and Joker's relationship should be. Whereas with this film, it's all about, hey, what if we distance ourselves from Bruce and Batman and give him just a way of how he starts going on these killing sprees and how he becomes the Joker. And I just was mind blown, because I didn't think, to be honest, when I watched the trailer earlier this year, I didn't think it was going to be that good. I honestly didn't. I was like, it looks beautiful, doesn't mean it's going to be good. And I was completely wrong. Like, arguably, top 10? No.
I have it in my top 5.
No, not top 5 of the year. I have it at number 5 at the moment, which is still really great for me. But in terms of comic book movies, I'll put this maybe top 5, top 10.
Yeah, because I would have it there.
Because this does something different for a character that's been going around on the turn of pages for almost 80 years, and nobody has dived in a way Todd Phillips and Joaquin has dived as this, you know, maniacal clown prince of crime that we have always seen, and twist it and put it in a way where not only does it reflect his psyche, but also reflects society as a whole, and what that would do to somebody was just mind-blowing. And I'm definitely recommending this. 4 out of 5 for me. I'm definitely buying it on 4K and Blu-ray when it comes out. Like, I don't know. Just, I feel like I can get something or learn something new every time this movie comes out. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can agree with that, but yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I'm going to try to go see it in 70mm sometime this week. Now that I have season pass, I can just go to those type of screenings. No, I thought it was really well done. I think they did a good job at indirectly making Joker responsible for the Wayne's death.
Yeah.
So, like, in Tim Burton's Batman, the Joker was previously Jack Napier, who did kill his parents. And then in Batman Begins, the Nolan trilogy, it's Joe Chill. It's just a nobody, which is how it is in most of the comics. It's just that's the whole point, is it's supposed to be, it doesn't matter who you are, like, it, all it takes is just some nobody, and that's why Batman does what he does, is there, it was just a random act of violence. Here, the Joker's killings and what's going on with the disconnect between classes in the society incites these basically class wars between the haves and the have-nots. And I do believe, because you have this unreliable narrator and because of Thomas Wayne telling him, I'm not your father, your mom's crazy, all that stuff, you were adopted, like, she didn't tell you any of this stuff, that immediately flipped Thomas Wayne to being a villain in the film.
Yes.
But because of the unreliable narrator, I don't think it's fair to trust that assumption, because there is a point where it's playing in the background, Thomas Wayne on TV, he's running for mayor, and he's talking about, like, wanting to clean up Gotham and help Gotham. Mm-hmm. And, like, the whole story with Batman was, and it was, and it's been said multiple, in multiple films or comics, when Alfred's talking to Bruce about his father, that he almost bankrupt the Wayne company trying to save the city.
Right.
Because and you can see how bad the city has gotten. And basically what they're not showing you in the Joker film is all of the resources and stuff Thomas Wayne is trying to put into this city to try to save it, because it's obviously a dying city.
And I feel like that was a great,
you don't want to show that, right? Because it's the Joker's story.
And I feel like that's why, in this entire film, that's why I was that's why I'm still stuck at, is some of it all real? Is none of it real? Or anything like that? Because literally the narration for him, and low-key the narration for Murray, all starts to change when certain pinpoints of the story happen. So like you said, when he's watching Thomas Wayne at the beginning, he's like, hey, everybody's my family, everybody is this, you know, I want to do what is best and can for the city, this, that, and the third, and things of that nature. Then it gets to the point where after he kills those kids, and he goes and meets Thomas, and Thomas tells him, no, you're, like, you're nothing, not nothing, but you're, like, not my son, and stuff like that. The news reports start becoming more and more antagonistic towards Thomas, and same thing with Murray, after Murray basically shows, you know, Arthur Fleck's character. Yeah. I mean,
then all he sees is Murray making fun of him.
Right, and that's what I mean, like, I want to believe that.
But I believe that actually Murray wasn't 100% making fun of him.
No.
Like, even when he shows up, he's still being nice to Arthur. But
right.
Arthur is only hearing what he wants to hear.
So that's, again, that's to my point. And that's why it's so crazy that, you know, again, this is why, like, I am excited that both of us are almost on the same wavelength here. Because Murray, when you see Murray compared to the Murray that you saw on a TV screen, yes, Murray is just all over, not all over the place, but he's, you know, making fun, he's joking, he's making fun of Arthur. But when he gets on the TV screen, or when he gets to talk to him and stuff like that, he's like a caring dad, you know? He's trying to make sure that...
He's like, you're doing all right. What's with the makeup? And then, like, even his producer's like, we can't have that. And he's like, no, that's it's what fine. He wants to it's do. Fine. It's fine.
And, he know, and even before he starts noticing that Arthur is crazy when he's having the interview, the entire way that Murray is navigating this interview is more of like, I just want to know what's wrong, like, what's going on. He's like that dad. It's like,
well, he says that I'm the one who killed those people, he was like, why did you do that? Why
right.
did you
want to? That's what I mean.
And they're, like, and they're telling him to cut it off.
But he's trying. He's like that dad that wants to understand why you did that. Why did you go to that point of killing these kids? And it wasn't until the end where, you know, Arthur started getting flustered and frustrated with.
Oh yeah, and he said you would like leave me. Like me or somebody like me, you would step over me to help somebody else who had money.
Right. He's like, people like me, if I was dying on the street, y'all just walk over me. But because it's these two, three little boys that Wayne has endorsed, everybody's flipping shit. And, you know, Murray is trying to navigate and trying to understand. So you're saying this is just, you're doing it for this. And so as soon as he starts attacking Arthur's philosophy, you could see that Arthur starts to get more and more enraged. It just starts building up to the point where he said, you know, where Arthur's like, all right, you know what? I mean, not Arthur. Murray's like, okay, you know what? I've got what I need to know. Yeah, we're going to end this conversation. Arthur, I guess that was a tipping point for Arthur at that point, and that's why he killed Murray at the end. And that's what I mean by I want to believe that some of this was real, but at the same time, you was already led to believe in the beginning that Arthur is just an unreliable ass narrator.
Mm-hmm.
Which parts of these?
But, I mean, that's the thing about the Joker is you're never supposed to know what he's saying is the truth and what's real.
And so that's why I gotta.
And that's the thing too is so you are you also of the mindset that everything after the car crash was in his head?
I believe so. Or, like I said, that was my first showing.
I think him getting pulled out by the followers and him standing on the top of the car and everything, I think that part was in his head.
Yes, I agree.
And then, but I think the part in Arkham was real.
Completely real. I agree. I feel like he literally was talking to to somebody from Arkham State Hospital. Or Arkham Asylum instead of just calling it Arkham Asylum. And he's literally trying to have this conversation with the lady. And he's laughing. And...
Well, he was thinking back to the killing.
Right, of Bruce and Thomas. I mean, of Thomas and Martha Wayne. And Bruce is in Crime Alley. And, you know, he just standing there watching his parents' dead bodies on the ground. And he's laughing. And she said, what's so funny? He said, you ain't get the joke. And I feel like that's the switch where it's like, okay, now Arthur's dead.
Then he completely goes Joker, which is, right. I'm going to kill my psychiatrist and then run around the asylum while orderlies try to chase me.
And that's why I was like, yeah, that's when you know for sure at that point, Arthur's dead. Arthur's not coming back. It's all but Joker now. And I thought, again, what one hell of a way to end this movie. Just showing, you know what? Fuck it. I know who I am now, and I am enjoying every moment of it. Because back in the day, he would try to explain his jokes, or he would try to, like, find a way to make
everybody laugh. He would always laugh at the wrong moments of other people's jokes.
Yeah.
Like, he wouldn't laugh at the beat or the drop.
It was always off beat.
So, one other thing I want to go over before we head out for the day. So I know Todd Phillips has said specifically, like, this is it. He's only doing the one. Joaquin Phoenix, who has always been against doing franchises.
Always.
Has been avoiding those type of questions. Like, will we see you as Joker again? I want to say there's one video interview where he just kind of turns and looks at the camera and smiles. And doesn't answer the question. I think that was
with Jimmy Fallon. I believe that was with him and Jimmy Fallon.
So I'm wondering, because now, essentially, with this, if you did, so you do Pattinson Batman, and it's a younger Batman. Obviously, you're not doing Batman Begins Batman, but you're doing, like, a younger Batman.
Right, like Arkham Origins Batman.
That kind of Batman. So, but do you tie this into your Matt Reeves Batman? Because then you've already handled the Bruce Wayne, the Batman origin. So that's one less thing we need to see in the Batman than the Matt Reeves movie. Joaquin Phoenix is not your Joker.
No.
He's, in my mind, he's what inspires
whoever's going to be the next Joker. Correct. Yes.
Kind of like in the comics, there's this character, Red Hood, who basically is crime in Gotham. There's always a Red Hood, and it goes down the line that eventually this one guy puts on the Red Hood to get paid because he needs money because his wife is pregnant and he's a struggling comedian. And then Batman shows up. He happens to fall in the acid. He becomes Joker. So I'm wondering if it's a Gotham always has a Joker and it's different people.
I was going to say, in my opinion, because I've been hearing a lot of conspiracy theories about it. Because there's also been things
in comics where I think it was like 3 or 4 years ago where the Joker came out and said something along the lines of, oh, I'm not the first one, or something along that.
That was in, I think, right before Rebirth in the New 52, if I remember correctly. But to your notion, I think that's what they're going to do. I don't want them to try to connect this to the DCU in any way, shape, or form. But I know they're going to try to with Matt Reeves' new Batman. And they're going to try to say, like, since your parents have died, you know, there's always been a Joker. And Joaquin was the very first one. And it's just going to be interesting to me to see who they're going to cast as the Joker and who they're going to put in that role. Because
if you want to tie this in with the Batman and you want that Batman to tie into Ben Affleck's Batman, you essentially put Matt Reeves' Batman, because this takes place in the early 80s.
Yeah.
You basically time that in like the late 90s, early 2000s. Basically, you would have flip phone Batman. You'd have Batman with a razor.
So basically, we're going back to 89 Batman, basically.
No, it'd be late 90s.
Like mid to late 90s? So
he'd be like 30.
Okay. All right. I mean, I wouldn't mind it. I wouldn't mind it.
Because then you could technically have a Joker that's not Jared Leto.
You'd have a young Joker.
Because Jared Leto, if you want to say Ben Affleck is who Robert Pattinson becomes, basically if Pattinson is Batman in 2000... the young and hopeful Batman who eventually becomes the torn down, broken Batman.
I mean, you can, but then I guess for me it's like, all right, then Matt Reeves...
I don't think he will, but I'm just saying they've laid a foundation where they could, based on them placing Bruce Wayne's parents' deaths in 81.
No, and I get you. I get you, and I like that idea. It's just for me, I guess, for me... Again, I don't want to see this being connected to a franchise. Do I want to be able to be like, yes, the one of my favorite Jokers, by the way, this is my second film Joker with Heath Ledger still above him. Would I want to see something like that happen? I mean, no, but I mean, I could understand why DC would want to do that just because of how controversial and how successful this movie is going to be. And at the same time, I agree. I believe Matt Reeves would have to do something in a way where when you see this happen, where you, like, let's say, for instance, for the young Batman, you get him aging, you have to start throwing the crumbs down on the floor for us to understand, okay, this is what led to Ben Affleck's DCEU Batman and stuff like that. And I don't know. I guess in my opinion, we both talked about this. I feel like they should just hit a hard reset button on the DCEU and just go about that. But because they're just going to continue going down this path, there's nothing we can do.
Well, that's the thing, is they don't want to get rid of the good ones they have. They don't want to get rid of Gal Gadot, Wonder Woman. They don't want to get rid of Momoa, Aquaman, and the Zachary Levi Shazam, because all of those did well. Obviously, they really liked Margot Robbie Harley Quinn.
That's why now, after watching the full trailer for Birds of Prey, I'm not as mad about it. It looks somewhat okay. I'm just mad that Ewan McGregor doesn't have the black mask.
I mean, he might. I think they're probably saving it.
Okay. But other than that, like, I don't know. I say all that to say, one, I'm excited for what they have done with this movie. But I'm also scared, like you said, that they're going to be trying to make it a franchise, or they're going to try to find a way to put Joaquin in the DCEU. And I don't want to see that, but I think that Warner Brothers is going to try to find a way to fit it in, and that's what's going to happen. So it is what it is. But with that, any closing thoughts?
No, like I said, it's mesmerizing, disturbing, uncomfortable. Did you have armed security at your theater?
So, because I had AMC stubs, then I canceled AMC stubs for season pass now. At the AMC, 110%. When I went to go watch it, there was a mall security, cop, and then by the 7 o'clock showing, because I was getting ready to go into 7 o'clock showing, there was three or four squad cops coming in and putting up for armed security at the mall. So, I was like, okay, all right, now we're beefing up security. But for the Alamo, the one that I went to, not really.
Okay. Yeah, when I went Thursday night, they had the counter-terrorist cop there
roaming. Oh, wow.
Okay. Yeah, they had like two or three of them constantly roaming around Fantastic Fest because it's considered a possible terrorist target. But they had one. And then at my buddy's at South Lamar, they also had one. And they were checking bags. And basically, they had the sign that said, like, by entering that Alamo Draft House, you consent to search of, you know, any bags or pockets and stuff. And at my screen, because I was in the, like, third row, they were rotating out servers standing at the front corner of the theater.
Yep, that's what they did for us.
Watching the audience.
Yeah, that's exactly what they did for us. Like, literally, they had a server on my right, on the left-hand side of the Alamo Draft House. And then I don't know if this dude was, like, actually part of the security or not, but he was sitting down, searching, looking around our audience, and then was go back to watching the movie. So I was like, okay, so obviously either he's being a little weird or he's actually part of security and just pretending to be somebody in regular clothes. And I saw that on Saturday night. So I didn't see that much security because I went to the one on South Lamar. I didn't see it. I went at it like 11, almost close to 11. So it wasn't that much, but like still you could tell that there was still security. So it wasn't that bad. But for sure on Thursday night, yeah, they beefed up security. But nonetheless, nothing happened. So, but I guess that will be it from us. Johnny, where can the kids find you?
You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Johnny the Wonder and Letterboxd Reviews at Johnny Boy Wonder.
And you could find me on Instagram and Twitter at King Julian Owens. Be looking at all of the other stuff that we'll be talking about. We have a full swing of Oscar movies that are coming out now. Next week, are you watching El Camino?
Yes, I'm going to watch. This weekend's actually pretty stacked.
Because, yes, it is.
El Camino and Gemini Man, The Addams Family, and Lucy in the Sky, maybe Jexy, maybe Judy.
Judy does come out this weekend. Wow. Okay.
So, yeah, a lot of stuff coming out. And then the following week, we have Zombieland Double Tap. And then I'm gathering that the Episode 9 trailer comes out next Monday, because that'll be the 14th, because Maleficent comes out on the 17th, so they can screen that trailer in front of
Maleficent. Right in front of Maleficent, yep.
So if I were a betting man, I would say Monday Night Football, hope you're the Lions and Packers.
Right, get your coins ready, because I think, like what they do every year for halftime, as soon as that trailer drops, get those clicking fingers ready.
Also, the viewership is probably going to be much higher this coming Monday night than the following, because this Monday night's Detroit Packers. The following Monday night is New England Jets. So probably going to drop on the 14th if I was a betting man.
Okay, yeah. All right, cool. So with that further ado, guys, good luck getting pre-tickets for Rise of Skywalker. We will be doing more movie reviews and things like that as it comes along. So stay tuned, guys. We'll be right here for you.
Later.